Let us go ahead and start first with the answers to quiz number two. So the first problem, determining configuration. First problem had what I guess you could call a trick question in it. Because just like I had done in class, I put a problem on here that does have part of the structure where it's written as dashes and wedges, but the left carbon that has that dash on it is actually not a stereocenter, since there are two methyl groups that are attached to that same common point. So whenever you do have two or more substituents that are exactly the same, you could draw a mirror plane through that particular carbon. Or another way of expressing it is, if you swapped those two groups, since they are the same, then there is no stereo configuration at that point. So for the first molecule, it's only carbon number 3, where it has the wedge end of the dash, that is, in fact, the stereocenter. So following the rules, the priority rules, we would first look at atomic number. Oxygen is higher atomic number than nitrogen. Nitrogen's higher atomic number than carbon, but we have two different carbon chains. One of them, at that first carbon out, you only have one other carbon attached. So the propyl group, there's only one carbon. But the other direction, the isopropyl group, at that attachment point, there are two carbons that come off of it. So two carbons beats out one carbon. So the isopropyl group is priority number 3. And then the propyl group is number 4. So this would appear to be S, but this structure is not correctly written for direct visualization, because the least important group, which is not hydrogen in this case, and it's not always hydrogen, but the least important group is not oriented in the back, so it's actually going to give you the misleading answer. What we could do is to imagine that we rotate around this single bond, make a rotamer of it, and we could put the propyl group in the back where it should be. And then if we did that, we could take the amino group, move it to the alcohol, and take the alcohol, put it where the propyl group is. If we do that, now we'll get our priorities of 1, 2, 3 processing in a clockwise direction, which means that stereocenter is in the R configuration. Questions about that problem? All right, then moving on to the second one. Each molecule was worth 4 points, and then if you had two stereocenters circled, you lost 2 points because one of them's not a stereocenter. Or if you only showed one stereocenter, but you could show enough work that I could see why you might have made a mistake in your configuration, then depending on the mistake, it might have been 1 or 2 points off. Or if you had a wrong answer but didn't have enough supporting work to show how you got to that answer, then unfortunately I had to mark the whole thing off. So for the second problem, each stereocenter you could say would be worth 2 points each. And there are two stereocenters in this next problem because the ring is not symmetric. So coming from that OH group, if you went clockwise versus counterclockwise, you'd end up with different priorities. So for that top stereocenter, oxygen is the most important versus either of the carbons attached. Going to the clockwise direction, we would get to a portion of the ring that is connected to a carbon and a deuterium, whereas going the other direction, we have a carbon and just hydrogens. Well, the second rule, the highest mass number, would apply in this case. So the direction that has the deuterium would be priority number 2. And then the one without the deuterium would be number 3. Hydrogen is already correctly written in the back, and so we can go ahead and read this configuration directly. and the configuration is R. Looking at the second stereo center, we again have two different substitution patterns depending on which way we go around the ring. Carbon is going to be higher priority than either deuterium or hydrogen, atomic number first. And so the direction that we have carbon with an oxygen is going to be more important than the direction with a carbon without that oxygen. The deuterium itself is priority number three, and then hydrogen is number four, but notice that the hydrogen is in front, which means whatever we visualize, we have to reverse. So it appears to be S, but it's really R. Questions about that molecule? Yes?
What is that 3 again?
The 3 is for the portion of the ring that is counterclockwise from the OH group. So going from that stereo center, if I go one position over, I've got one side that has deuterium and one side that doesn't. Since everything else is equal as you keep going, that's the first point of difference, and deuterium gets the higher priority. Yes? Not for absolute configuration, though, because cis and trans are relative terms. So cis and trans you can use if you just want to refer to what the relative positions between them are. But if you're trying to name it using the R and S convention, you have to use R and S. Well, I had hopefully made that clear, but I guess it must have been misinterpreted. Other questions about that molecule? Okay, then the last one. The last one only had one stereo center because the right-hand side, where it's planar, since it's planar, it is its own mirror image. And on the other side, where you have a wedge, even though you've got a wedge, you again have a situation where you have two of the same substituent. So the only stereo center is in the middle of the molecule. But in order to answer this then, we're going to have to use phantom atoms to figure out how to correctly read the double bond. So rewriting. You double up the oxygen that's connected to the carbon, and then on each oxygen, you're going to double up the carbon. So there's our set of phantom atoms. Now if we look at what we've got, from the stereo center, you've got carbons in three directions. So we have a carbon that's got oxygens, a carbon that's got oxygens, a carbon that only has hydrogens. That third one will be the least important. So we'll go ahead and assign that priority 3. The hydrogen, which is there, would be priority 4. Notice that it's in the front again, so whatever we're about to come up with for the order, we remember we got to reverse it. Now, comparing the two other carbons, we have a carbon with two oxygens, carbon with two oxygens. That's the same, so we have to go one more position out. In this first case, the oxygen only has hydrogen on it, versus in the other case, oxygen has carbon on it. Since carbon is more important than the hydrogen, that makes the group on the right have higher priority than the group on the left. And so even though it appears S because hydrogen's in front, it's really R. Questions on that molecule? right, let's move on to the next problem then, which is on nomenclature. So first of all, this is a 5-carbon molecule, so it's going to be some form of pentanol. Since the OH group is on the first carbon, it's going to be pentane-1-ol, or 1-pentanol. We have two different substituents. There's a deuterium that's located at the point where the alcohol is. Deuterium's substituent name is deuterone, just like chlorine, chloro, bromine, bromo. Then we have the methyl group at the 1, 2, 3, 4 position. Since the D in deutero comes before the M in methyl, we're going to list this as 1-deutero-4-methyl. And then we do have a stereocenter. Again, the one on the very left is not a stereocenter because you've got two of the same substituent attached. On the right-hand side, oxygen is priority 1, carbon is priority 2, deuterium is priority 3. The hydrogen that's there is already in the back, and so this is S. But because it's only one stereocenter that needs specification in this compound, you do not use numbers in front of that S. If we had multiple stereocenters, then we would put those position numbers in. Yes?
I thought the numbering for a certain situation is
optional. Well, I'll have to check the IUPAC rules, but the way I'd expressed it in class is that you do leave it out. And standard practice is to leave it out. Mentioned it in class, but I'll check the IUPAC rules to see if it is incorrect to put it in or not. So moving on to the next problem, that was for the terminology of enantiomers, diastereomers, and epimers. So most of you got the definitions correct, and you might have expressed it one of a couple of ways. For enantiomers, you might have said that those are non-superimposable mirror images. Another way you could have said that then is that the stereocenters, all the stereocenters from one form to the other, are inverted. For diastereomers, they're non-superimposable non-mirror images. If you just said that it had stereocenters, that's not enough because enantiomers have stereocenters as well. You could say they're non-superimposable images, which is true, but then you have to say that they're non-mirror images, because enantiomers are also non-superimposable. Another way that you could have said it is that one or more of the stereocenters are changed, but then you had to say not all of them, because if all of them changed, you'd be back to enantiomers again. And then epimers are a subset of diastereomers in which only one configuration has been changed. Now, where most of you had some difficulty was writing the example molecules. For enantiomers, for example, some of you might have done something like this, which you had exactly the right idea, but realize that those are not enantiomers because they're both exactly the same molecule. Because there is no stereocenter, because if you look at it, you've got three of the same substituent all located on the same carbon. So an example of a pair of molecules that are enantiomers would be something like this. For diastereomers, since it's some but not all of the stereocenters that change, you needed to have at least two stereocenters on it. Now, it's not that you couldn't use methyl groups to show stereocenters, you just need to make sure that they really were stereocenters. So this would be an example of showing diastereomers. And then for epimers, Again, you needed to show at least two stereo centers. And for one, for an epimer, you needed to show that only one of those changed.
Questions about that problem? Yes. Yes, because only one stereo center has changed. So technically, you could have even used the same example. Yeah?
So, like, you know what I mean? You know, I don't see why this is necessary. I changed it to that.
But that is part of the problem, to know what really an enantiomer would be. And since it's meso, it can't have an enantiomer.
What is this
meso?
Because
it's got a mirror plane.
So if I jump
then it wouldn't have been these, right? All right, now the last problem, whether the molecules were chiral or not. So in this question, if you wanted to say something that was chiral, you couldn't just say that it had stereocenters, because the first molecule is chiral, and it does have stereocenters, but the last molecule, it turns out, is not chiral, even though it has stereocenters. So what you have to say, if you're going to focus on the stereocenter version of explaining it, is yes, it has to have stereocenters, but it also cannot have an internal mirror plane. So for the first molecule, there is no mirror plane. Which, as some of you expressed, that means that if you took the mirror image of that molecule, that mirror image is not going to be identical to the original one. So you'd end up with non-superimposable mirror images, which means that this does have handedness. So that, because it does have handedness, it is chiral. For the last one, since I already mentioned it, it does have a mirror plane. Since it does have a mirror plane, even though it's got stereocenters, it is achiral because it's meso. And then for the middle molecule, it does have a mirror plane as well. But it turns out there aren't any actual stereocenters there. Because from each of those positions with a wedge or a dash, if you went either direction around the ring, you'd end up having exactly the same substitution pattern. So you can't say it's meso in that case, because meso means having stereocenters. But you could still, in this case, say it is achiral, because there are no stereocenters. Questions about that last problem? All right, so we don't have a heck of a lot of time, but I want to go over one of the problems from the first exam, the smog diagram problem, since there seems to be a fair amount of difficulty writing smogs. So the problem that we had was this, where we had both a lone pair and a radical. So first, let's rewrite this as a full structure to make sure we've got the right number of atoms, right number of hydrogens in particular. So first,
Rewriting this, there are 5 carbons in the compound. On the leftmost carbon, because there's only one sigma bond shown, since there are 3 bonds shown, there's one missing, so that's one hydrogen. The second carbon over, it's already got 4 bonds shown, so it doesn't need another hydrogen. Third carbon, the lone pair itself would have come from one bond with hydrogen, but that means there's one more left over. And similarly on the radical, with there being one electron left from what would have been a hydrogen, that means there's, again, one hydrogen left. And on the last carbon, because it only has one bond showing so far, that means there's going to be 3 hydrogens. Now for determining hybridization, we look at sigma bonds and lone pairs. We ignore pi bonds, and we ignore individual electrons. Individual electrons just don't have the repulsive force of pairs of electrons, and so that's why we don't count those. And then since we could model pi bonds as coming from just one electron on each atom, again, that would mean that that doesn't have an effect on hybridization. So first 2 carbons, they're both going to be sp hybridized. The third and the fifth, because they each have 4 pairs, either in sigma bonds or in lone pairs, that means they'll both be sp3. And then the remaining carbon, because it has that lone electron, is only going to be sp2 hybridized. So when we go to write the smog, one common misunderstanding, it seems to be that somehow the hybridization applies to the bond. But no, the hybridization applies to an atom. So if you double-check your smogs, if you pointed to where the bond would be and called that some particular hybridization, that's not how the model works. We take each atom, write out its orbitals, and then if they happen to overlap, then that's where bonds form. But within a bond, it could be made up of orbitals that are, by the system, 2 different hybridizations. So for sp, sp means there are 2 different orbitals. For sp3, it's going to automatically mean there are 4 orbitals. And for sp2, there are only 3 orbitals. Now I'll go ahead and put my hydrogens in. And then, the sp2 hybridized orbital, since it only used up 3 of the valence orbitals, we have a p orbital that's left over. The sp3, since we've used up the sp, p, and p, there is nothing left. So there won't be any p orbitals on sp3 hybridization. And on the sp, because we only use 2 of the orbitals in hybridization, that means there's going to be 2 sets of p orbitals left over. Now, there's 2 types of bonds we have. In the triple bond, there are the 2 sets of p orbitals that overlap. And so those are our pi bonds. And then anywhere where you've got head-to-head overlap of orbitals, all of those places would be sigma bonds. So there is the full smog diagram for this molecule. Any questions on this problem?
What's that?
Sigma bonds between anywhere there's a head-to-head. You got it? The lone pair goes there. And actually, let me fill in my smog a bit.
Yes. The hyperconjugation could occur from this sp3 center over back to the triple bond or to this p orbital, and hyperconjugation could also happen from this sp3 hybridized system into that. But you weren't asked to show it, so you didn't have to indicate it on this diagram. So either of the two sp3 hybridized centers would be able to hyperconjugate with the p orbitals that are right next to it. So the middle carbon could hyperconjugate on either side of it, and then the n carbon could hyperconjugate with the p orbital next to it. Other questions? All right, then. For your lab reports, so those of you who turned in paper lab reports, I've handed those back. Those of you who have emailed me, I'm working on emailing those back. Just some mostly small problems I saw with the report. I purposely did not talk about the fact that you're not going to end up with 100% total for your percentages if you calculate your percent composition by looking at how much compound that was recovered versus the starting mass of your starting material. And it should be expected we wouldn't get 100% back, because you could see product loss as you did your experiment. Any of that white film that you got when the ether evaporated, that's lost product, or anything that stayed stuck under the side of your flasks. So if you addressed it in some way, that's all I was really looking for, to see if you were trying to really look at your data and analyze it. So some of you correctly pointed out that you might have product loss, or if you had more than 100% composition. You know, it's not physically possible for you to have more than 100%. So some of you also then commented that you might not have had all your solvent evaporate. So you needed to at least address this issue of the composition not coming out to be 100%, because the expectation would be that if you're trying to figure out percentages, they should add up to 100. Beyond that, there were a few of you that had some issues in the different sections of your report. So, purpose section, remember that you need to clearly state what the goal of your experiment is, and then that goal should be reflected in your conclusion statement. So some of you had purpose and conclusion statements that didn't have any correspondence with each other. So remember that you need to structure it that way. The suggestion for this first report was that a good purpose statement would have been to determine the composition of an unknown mixture or two unknown mixtures, in which case he would have reported back in the conclusion section what the compositions of the mixtures were. For the data section, it looks like most of you did okay with the inclusion of units and then trying in some way where it was logical to use tables. For the calculation sections, some of you showed full calculations for each one of the calculations that you performed. And what I had asked that is, if you have a situation where you have multiple similar calculations, that you only show the full calculation once, and otherwise just tabulate your results. In your conclusion, and actually throughout your report, it is fine if you want to discuss theory, but remember that you're not required to. And also analyzing sources of error. Some of you were trying to identify good sources of error, but one thing that I saw a few times is commenting on human error. So there's always going to be the possibility you're going to have human error, but in scientific reports, we don't focus on it. We focus on how do we avoid that. So there's no need to mention, for example, that you might have measured incorrectly using the balance, because the idea is that you've taken what reasonable steps you can to make sure that you're using equipment correctly. Something else I just remembered. Some of you are using first person in your lab reports. So remember that for this class, we're not going to do reports that are structured using I, we, my, our, us, any of those first-person words. And then beyond that, I'm trying to think if there were any common problems that I saw. I don't think so. Yes.
What we have is a range.
Right, and so if you took the middle of that range, that's what's typically done for melting points, which I believe that question... I think that question had come up in class. So yeah, your percent error itself may have a little range to it, but that's going to be expected for temperatures. Now that reminds me though, some of you tried to calculate percent error on the compositions themselves, which... I never did state that the mixtures were half and half on part A for those compounds, or one-third, one-third, one-third. That's an assumption that you can't make. So if you tried to calculate a percent error, that was based on data that didn't exist. So just make sure that you are doing appropriate types of calculations. But most of our reports won't even have calculations, so we may not even run into that issue again. Yes?
We could have lost some of the stuff in the process, but what else could be in the original circuit here that could count for something less than 100%?
Actually, it would just have to be pretty much just loss of product. So, right, either when you were handling the ether, if it evaporated and left it deposited somewhere, or if you were trying to do the recrystallization and some of it maybe stuck to your glassware. That's really the only way I think it would come up with less than 100%. To come up with more than 100%, then you'd have solvent that failed to be evaporated. All right, now as far as what we're doing the rest of the day, let me ask, how many of you still have IRs that you need to take? Oh, very few. This section got pretty far. Okay, then the only thing that we need to do today is I did prepare a para anisaldehyde stain. It seems to be working much better than the previous recipe that we've found, although it's not giving the best possible results because there was one unexpected glitch with the TLC plates that we're using, which is they're melting under the processing of the TLC stain. So let me explain how we're going to do the stain and how to maybe avoid some of the issues that the other sections have had. So the para-anisaldehyde stain is just going to be in a container that I'll run get as soon as we're done. You just dip your TLC plate in it, leave it in just for a moment, pull it right back out, and let any excess of the stain drip off of it. You're then going to use what's called a heat gun, which is nothing more than an industrial hair dryer. It does have a low heat setting and a high heat setting. I'm presuming that the other sections may have been mostly using the high heat setting. What I'm going to suggest, particularly for the first couple of you that get to using these, try the low heat setting first. What I'm going to hope is that a prolonged low heat will allow us to cause the stain reaction to develop without causing the plates to melt. Now, the stain doesn't just have para-anisaldehyde in it. It's a solution of para-anisaldehyde and ethanol, but also does have concentrated sulfuric and acetic acids in it. So you need to handle the plates using tweezers at first, at least, until you do heat it up and evaporate off the stain. But because you're going to be heating, I would, again, recommend that you use tweezers or something to hold that plate as you're heating it. One of the sections I have tried suggesting them put them on a paper towel, but for whatever reason, that seemed to make it actually worse than the other section that did just hold it up in the air. That one section that did hold it up in the air, some of the dots turned a very distinctive purple, some of them turned a distinctive yellow, and some of them seemed to remain white. If it didn't turn colors, that in itself is a piece of information. But whether things do or don't turn colors, that should hopefully be additional information for you to help identify which unknowns are in your mixture. Now, the due date for the lab report I had made for this Thursday, But I ended up pushing sections 1 and 2 back to Friday for the due date. And for this section, I don't mind if you were to turn it in Friday as well. If you already have it ready, you can go ahead and turn it in Thursday. But like I said, if you'd like to have the same amount of time they're going to have, you can turn it in Friday. If you've already sent me a lab report, please do incorporate your TLC stain information, unless somehow you threw your TLC plates away or can't find them, in which case just make sure to note in your lab report that you don't have, or that the TLC plates were not available. And since most of you have already finished your IR, I'll go ahead and open up the IR for the couple of you need to use it. But once you are done with your TLC stain, then you're done with lab for today.